every time I go on television that I really have a radio face. So, so we don't really need that much light, you know. Of course, I have to be careful, too. You know, the other day, I was giving a lecture, and I said, would you turn the lights down a little more, a little more, a little more? And pretty soon, you know, they had all the lights off. And I thought, well, that's okay. They'll really be able to see the screen. So I gave one of my really stirring talks. I mean, I was on that night. The only problem was, when I got all done, we turned the lights back on. I was alone in the room. I just hate it when people do that. But... yeah, let's see. This is Answers in Genesis here. We're on the web. How many have looked us up on the internet? Well, those of you that have computers and have not yet done so, I urge you to check us out. Easy address to remember. Just remember, Answers in Genesis, the capitalization is not important as far as the computer is concerned. And it's answersingenesis.org. And it's one of the top, in fact, this past year, it was ranked the top Christian website in the nation. So it's really pretty special. And the people they have working on it, believe me, are not amateurs. They don't have amateurs around there doing anything. It's just done first class and at a very sophisticated level. If you have questions that come up, things you read about in the paper, I just am putting an article, a big one up on the website on this so-called walking fish, Tiktaalik. You may have heard about here a few weeks ago. They were all excited. This is the fish that evolved into man. Yeah, you didn't know you came from fish. So anyway, you can look things up there. There's a search engine, and it's really pretty powerful. In fact, when we get done here talking about the development of the baby, I might just tell you a little bit more about the museum and the building that's up there. I have a little video I can show you on that. Otherwise, I'm pleased you're all here this evening, and... this is the last of the series of talks that we have arranged to do here. And I think we've saved the best for the last. That's my feeling anyway. This is one of my favorite talks. As a grandfather, I love my little grandkids and had children of my own. And the development of the baby in the womb just has to be as remarkable as it gets, isn't it? I mean, there are a lot of things in the body pretty amazing. You know, we talked about the eye and the ear, and that's pretty amazing. I'll admit that. But that's just two of the things that develop in the baby. That's just two of the things. In fact, I'm going to talk about an organ this evening that I'm just going to tease you a little bit here. I'm going to talk about what is probably, maybe after the brain, the most amazing, most phenomenal organ in the body, and that organ you've not had in your body. What organ of the body is that important, but it's not really part of your body? I called it super organ when I taught at the medical school. When I said super organ, my students knew what I was talking about. I didn't have to go any further. We're going to talk about super organ. Super organ is the placenta. Isn't that true? You didn't have your own placenta in your body. If you are a mother, you had the placenta in your body of your child. But here's an organ that sits outside of our body that's attached by blood vessels that just does everything. I mean, it does everything. Everything, I guess, except think. And when the baby's born, we just throw it away, right? Don't give it a second thought. Believe me, when you learn about the placenta, you are going to thank God for the placenta, for the next baby that's born in your family, I guarantee. Well, let's look at these wonderful little children and how they develop in the womb, and we're going to stick to the early stages of development. I'm not going to try to show you how the heart develops and the liver and the lungs, and oh, that would take months. We'd have to devote a year to that. We're going to look at the early stages of development. You're looking at a little stillborn baby here. It's kind of sad, and one of the first things we learn that although it is our Father's world because He created it, right now at least, Satan is the prince of this world. And for all of the beauty that we can see of the handiwork of God, the devastating impact of sin is everywhere. When I taught gross anatomy, which is a dissection of the human body, to medical students, two things really struck me. One, how magnificently constructed this body is. I was always especially amazed at the hand. One of these days I'm going to do a lecture on the hand. And then as soon as that impression went by, the next thing that hit me is, what a mess. What a devastated mess this body is. Naturally, the bodies that we would dissect in the gross anatomy suite were from people who had become seriously ill and died. And we'd see every kind of tumor, every kind of surgical procedure, every kind of birth defect, every kind of aneurysm, osteoporosis, every type of cancer. And it wasn't a pretty sight. How can something be so beautiful and so utterly destroyed? And we need to keep that in mind. Yes, this is a beautiful world we're in. The organs we'll talk about, the developmental process is beautiful, but superimposed on that is the ugliness of sin. And God is really serious about sin. So serious that he had to send his own son to die for us. So here's a little baby right here that died. You're looking at the picture. It's still attached to its umbilical cord. I use the word baby because, you know, it's really all a baby, isn't it, from the time of conception. But scientists and physicians have special names for each stage as the baby develops. We call a very, very first fertilized egg, we call that a zygote. A little later, they might call it a conceptus. They call it a morial. They call it a blastocyst. We would call this stage right here an embryo. That little baby is 7 weeks of development from the time of the fertilization. That's 7 weeks you'd see there. You can see already the fingers, the toes, the eye, the ear. The heart's been beating since almost the first week before the mother ever knew that she was pregnant. And 7 weeks into the world, and this little baby's dead. And it's pretty sobering. Another week, if this little child would have lasted another week, it would have been 8 weeks of development, then its name would magically change from embryo to fetus. It's still a little baby. Don't let these names ever let you think that it's anything other than a child. The Bible describes the condition of a woman who's pregnant as being how? With fetus, with embryo, with zygote, no, with child. So with that said, in that little introduction, you can see the title of this lecture should be familiar to you, Fearfully and Wonderfully Made, comes from Scripture. And get it from the Old Testament. Here in the book of Jeremiah, also from the Old Testament, chapter 1, verse 5, it reads, very interesting, it says, before I formed you. Who's talking here? God. God says, before, he's talking to you, before I formed you. He's actually talking to Jeremiah, but he's talking to all of us too. The Bible's written not just for Jeremiah, it's written for all of us. But he's saying to Jeremiah, before I knew you, or before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you. I ordained you a prophet to the nations. This is before he was born. Now today, we ask the big question. It's supposed to be the ultimate puzzler in the same category of what came first, the chicken or the egg. It was the chicken, of course. That's easy. But when does life begin in the womb? How many have heard that question? When does life begin in the womb? Big, big question, huh? It's really not a good question at all. You want to know the absolute answer to it, and nobody can deny it? Life does not begin in the womb, period. You see, if we ever went to a place where there was no life, you know, if we could turn a switch and there's no life, you'd never turn it on again. You wouldn't turn it on again in the womb. You wouldn't turn it on again anywhere. It'd be over. Life doesn't start in the womb. Where did life start? If you ask when did life begin, you can say exactly when life began. For man, life began on what? The sixth day of creation. God created man. Did the children of Adam come from dead inanimate matter? They came from the living bodies of Adam and Eve. And their children came from the living bodies of their children, and on down the line, generation after generation, life does not begin in the womb. I don't think that's really what people are asking anyway. We shouldn't be too hard on them when they ask that question. I think what they really mean to say, they're just not being as precise as they ought to be. When does a person begin in the womb? Wouldn't that be something of interest? When does a person? Well, we'd have to define what we mean by a person. I thought about it, and I came up with this definition. I think it's as good as any. Probably wouldn't meet a psychologist's definition or whatever, which means I'm probably on the right track. I would define a person as someone known to God who has a soul. Wouldn't that be pretty good for starter? And when a person begins, of course, the Lord knows persons even before the worlds were formed. Before the worlds were formed, he knew us, and we can't go there. That's way too heavy for our minds. But if we just stick to what we can understand, the Lord speaks of that which is developing in the womb as a person, somebody that God knows. And so we know that from the time that the egg is fertilized and a new genetic material is produced, we have a new person. And that person's actually being actively formed by God. There's some amazing verses that just pretty, as far as I'm concerned, settle the whole abortion issue for me. Because, you know, you can argue all you want why we should not abort the baby, and you're just puffing a little wind unless you refer to Scripture. A very famous television theologian was on the Larry King show. I won't use names because I don't want to smear this individual or anything, but I'll talk about what he said. Larry King says, so you don't like abortion? So fine, don't have abortion. So why are you down on everybody else having an abortion? What's wrong with it? And he said, well, it's just not correct. It's not right. It's not what we should do. He didn't say that it was against the word of God to take the life there. So we need to, I think, refer to the word of God to defend the pro-life view, not just tradition or something like that. Psalm 139, this is where the text or the title comes from the lectures, verse 13 through 14. For you, that is God, created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. Now, I love that word, knit. I just have a mental image of God knitting in there. Maybe the mother's doing some knitting, huh? Some booties for the baby? Hey, that's nothing. While the mother's knitting the booty, in the womb, the Lord's knitting the baby. And I know, you know, you look at a word like that, you say knit, well, it's a figure of speech, and I can see that it is to some degree that, but here's a little thing you ought to think about. My particular field of expertise is a field called histology. I was the histology editor for 5 editions of Stedman's Medical Dictionary, so that's an area in which I have some expertise. And I was course master of that course at Washington University School of Medicine. And histology comes from the Greek word histos, and that means fabric. Something which is woven. Because the early anatomists, as they began to look through microscopes at the human body, they thought, my goodness, it's woven. The connective tissue is woven. I talked about the eye the other day and how it got pumped up with a little pump, had to be pumped up to a certain pressure and maintained there, just like a tire. The eye has a very inelastic wall. It's like a conveyor belt. It doesn't stretch, because if it stretched, it wouldn't be a good optical camera, would it? It would get a little too big or a little too small, depending on the pressure. The reason it doesn't stretch is because the fabric of the eye is woven like a conveyor belt. The fibers are like one layer like this, and next like this, and next like this, and next like this. It's not like a double knit. You see, our skin is stretchy. It's made out of the same kind of fibers as you have in the wall of the eye. These fibers, by the way, are stronger than steel and less elastic than steel. And yet, look how stretchy. Now, when you get older, you pull a thing up like this and you let go on me, you can count to 10 before it goes down. When you're younger, you dip, you're just like that, see? But how can How can we be made out of chainmail and be so elastic? It's the way it's woven. It's woven like a double-knit suit. Everything is due to the weave. And you know how the waistband on shorts and stuff will have a kind of a rubber in there? Well, we have that too. You have the non-elastic, like the cotton cords, which in this case are more like steel, and they're woven in a certain way. Then you have like little rubber strands. It's called elastin. And that helps to pull it back to its original configuration again. Our body is woven. And here's the Lord saying, I did the weaving. I was in the womb knitting. So once again, for you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. That is why God is deserving of praise. Says that in Revelations, because he is our creator. If he stood idly by while nature ran its course, then we are not accountable to him. If he comes down to our part of the world to see what went on over here while he was absent, and oh my goodness, there's people here. I wouldn't have expected that, not from an expanding cloud of hydrogen gas. Wow, this is incredible. If he starts telling me what to do, I'll say, who are you? Be like me going over to my neighbor and saying, you know, your kids really ought to be washing the dishes and mowing the lawn and doing a little more work around the house. What's my neighbor going to tell me? Go mind your own business. Doesn't even make any difference if I'm right. Because they're not my children. But God is our creator. He made us. We didn't make ourselves, as the Bible says. And so he is deserving of praise because we are fearfully and wonderfully made. Then this last phrase is it's one of those magnificent understatements in the Bible that says, your works are wonderful, and I know that full well. I can imagine someday a really modern Bible translation. Probably have a name like the Hip Translation. It would just use the latest jargon. I mean, it wouldn't be a Bible I would use, but I can imagine that happening. And this verse, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made, your works are wonderful, and I know that full well. In the Hip Bible, it would say, your works are wonderful, and that's like a no-brainer. Or that's obvious. Completely obvious. Psalm 139 goes on to say, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. In other words, our body, our skeleton, our frame was not hidden from God when we were developing in the womb, i.e., he was looking on. Was he really looking on? Yes, we'll go on and read. When I was woven, there it is again, God is weaving. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, that's kind of a euphemism for the uterus. A hidden place, depths of the earth. It means a place where folks didn't get a chance to look back in those days. The day with sonograms and everything, we can kind of look around, can't we? But they couldn't then, but they still knew the baby was forming there. God was looking on. Do you realize what this means? This means that when we do an abortion, we are essentially doing the following. We're walking in, God's in there knitting, he's working. And we push him aside and we say, stand aside, God, we're going to kill this one. I know that's blunt. I don't show pictures of aborted babies and that kind of thing. I don't appeal to that kind of thing. But I make this blunt statement just to show what an offense it must be to God. And yet God is so merciful, he forgives us for even this. And I've been guilty of as bad and worse. And he had to forgive me. In fact, I've always assumed I must be the worst sinner on earth, but I'm comforted by the fact that there was one worse sinner than me. So at the worst, I can only be the second worst sinner on earth. The Apostle Paul was the worst. He said he was chief of sinners. The most I can be is second best. Second to the Apostle Paul. And I know he was saved, so I know there's hope for me. I know the Lord can forgive me. And he can forgive you if you have had an abortion or whatever. We go to the Lord and say, Lord, I didn't know. I'm sorry. I would not do it again. And then it says, all the days were ordained for me, were written in your book of life before one of them came to be. These are things too deep for us to really understand. We can read them and think a little bit, but not too much. Now, when I was active in the academic world as a professor, I found I had to read Ecclesiastes through at least once every year. I'll tell you, when you're a professor at one of the really major medical schools and you've got all these spectacularly bright students hanging on your heels and your words, you can really get a big hit. I was getting to the point where I go through a doorway, my ears were taking a beating on the doorframe. And I find if I just read the book of Ecclesiastes, my head would just go kind of come down to normal size as all the hot air went out. Oh, so many wonderful things in that book. They say it was written by Solomon. He had everything. And he basically said, nothing new under the sun. Of the writing of books, there is no end. With much learning comes much grief. Boy, does that let the air out of you. But before I would talk about the development of bones to my medical students, this is the one time when I would read a Bible verse. And I would read Ecclesiastes before we started talking about the development of the baby. And this is what he says in 11:5. As you do not know the path of the wind, or how the body, the King James has the bones, how the body is formed in a mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. Now that pretty much takes all the pride out of you. We're about ready to look at how the baby develops in the womb, and the Lord is basically telling us you're really not going to understand much of anything. Oh, you learn a lot. You learn so much, you'd be begging me to stop because your brain's going to be full. But we're not even scratching the surface. The Lord's just sitting back and laughing and says, I'm glad you learned it. I mean, it'll give you a thrill. That's good. But believe me, you don't even know the first steps. So with that in mind, let's dig. Let's look. This is the uterus. It sits low, very low, in the below the abdomen, down in the pelvic region. And it's a muscular structure. It's made out of smooth muscle, which means we don't have voluntary control over it. And it's hugely distensible. It's really tiny. I mean, when you see it, particularly in gross anatomy in older people, it's just a little tiny thing. You can't even imagine that that could be a uterus, assuming it's still there. Usually it isn't. They've been removed, which again is just devastating effects of sin. But we know that can swell to a size where it can accommodate to about 20 pounds of fluid and baby and what have you. It's amazing. And this muscle is all automatic. It runs on autopilot. On either side, and the uterus sort of sits in the womb leaning forward, sort of like bending like this. And it's held in position by a broad ligament on each side. This broad ligament has been given a really clever name. It's called the broad ligament. I'm not going too fast, am I? I didn't think so, no. Yeah, the broad ligament holds it in position here. And also, it holds the ovary. Here's an ovary here and one here. You have two of them, like so many things in the body. You know, two eyes, two nostrils, two ears, but one mouth. There's a lesson there, I guess, huh? Two arms. So we have two ovaries, and the ovaries are where the eggs develop. And they each kind of take turns, not exactly in take turns, but both ovaries are used to ovulate. And the ovulation really means just releasing the egg, and the egg comes out of the surface of the ovary, and it has to enter this little tube here. This tube is called the egg tube. Fancy name is oviduct, which means egg tube. I mean, if we called it an egg tube rather than an oviduct, you'd all know what we were talking about. And so we tend to use Latin and Greek and things like that, so we come off sounding a lot smarter than we are. But the egg has to go in this little tube. It gets fertilized about in here, or conversely, over here. And then after it's fertilized, it continues down the tube, enters the uterus, and there it plants like a seed. And the lining of the uterus is rather like the soil, and the egg is like the seed. And this whole process is pretty amazing. The end of the tube is funnel-shaped, and it's been given a really creative name, the end of that tube. It's called the funnel, except they use the Latin, the infundibulum. And so the egg will be caught there and will go down the tube. Let's look at these ovaries in more detail. We'll start there. By the way, the size of one of these ovaries in a healthy female would be the size of an almond nut. So if you've got in mind an almond nut, not the hole in the shell, just the nut inside. Easily see them without a microscope. Let's look at one of those ovaries. This is inside, just in a drawing. But here are all the eggs. Now, when a baby girl is born, there's over a million eggs already in place, ready to go. In fact, no more eggs are made. By the time the baby girl is born, there is no more production of eggs. She has all the eggs she's ever going to have. In fact, a lot of those break down. By the time the female reaches reproductive age, this little girl gets to reproductive age, 15, 16 years old or so, she'll have about 500,000 eggs, all of which were there when she was born. It isn't like the male reproductive system where sperm's being made all the time. No, no. And the female, that's it. You've got them. And these eggs, about every 28 days, if you're on an absolutely regular schedule, roughly a month, about 40 of them will begin to develop. What do we mean? They're surrounded by cells, the egg, and that's called a follicle, eggs in the follicle. The egg is a big cell. See this right here? That's the egg. Notice how big it is. All the other cells are little dots. But this is big. The dot in the middle is the nucleus. And so they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And of the 40, typically all of them will break down. Process we call atresia. They just break down spontaneously, except one. And this one becomes a big follicle, sometimes called the Graafian follicle. And this is full of a fluid. A little spot on the surface of the ovary will thin out, and that egg will be ejected outside. Now, right here, we got ourselves a first-class miracle on our hands. That egg is going to tear right through the peritoneum. What on earth is that? You know, when you open up somebody's body and you look inside, you think you're inside, wouldn't you? I mean, you can see kidneys and all that stuff in there and intestines. You're still really not inside, because imagine if you had a sheet of plastic, or let's say a plastic, one of these freezer bags, and you push your fist in from the back. The bag is closed and sealed. And the bag, let's say, has a little oil in it, so it's slippery. If you push your fist from the back and you looked at it from the front, if you cut away one sheet of plastic, you'd still have the other sheet covering your fist, wouldn't you? If you cut away one side of the bag, the other side would still be covering your fist. That's the way all of the organs are in the body. They're behind a membrane called a peritoneum. And there really is nothing out in that space except lubrication. And that allows everything in the body to slip really nice. You have a bag like that around your heart, a double wall bag, and as the heart is beating, that's slipping, that lubrication. If you didn't have that, if the heart was just in there rubbing against the chest cavity, your body core temperature would go sky high and you'd be dead within an hour. But by having that lubricated double bag there, or double wall, you know, the bag, it can slip. Same thing with the lungs. The lungs are big or smaller. You can have that pleural sac that's lubricated again. So throughout the body, we have this this wonderful system, and the ovary itself is behind one of these membranes, and so this egg actually breaks through, and for a split second, it's out in the peritoneum where there isn't supposed to be anything except lubrication, and the oviduct has to catch it. And if the oviduct doesn't catch it, it can theoretically be fertilized out there in a peritoneum. Some sperm could get out there, and that would be an ectopic pregnancy, a peritoneal pregnancy, and that would be a medical emergency. I'm going to have to do something about that right away. Now, each of these eggs has a half set of chromosomes, you might say. Our bodies, our cells, have a double set. One set we got from mom, and one set from dad. Are you aware of that? A double set of chromosomes. Now, when you make an egg or a sperm cell, you have to get down to a single set. Because when the two cells get together, that restores the double set again, right? Otherwise, every time a sperm and an egg got together, you'd be doubling the chromosomes each time. Eventually, the cells would be as big as the sun. So you have to have the number of chromosomes. And that all has happened before the baby was born, and they're all sitting here ready to go. Now, I've heard people contemplate, how do we get all the different kinds of people groups in the world, starting with just Adam and Eve? I mean, how do you get black folks and white folks and red folks and Oriental people? How do you get all these different people starting with just one pair? I got a question for you. Where did Eve get her eggs from? Anybody know? From her mom? From her biological father? Where did Adam get his germ cells from? From his father, his mother? got them from God. Is that a safe assumption so far? Didn't get them from parents, got them from God? You think God would make them all the same, all those eggs? I suspect that I assume Eve had 500,000 eggs, just as women do today. It's a safe starting place anyway, right? Would have looked pretty much like ladies do today, and Adam like men. But I can easily imagine every egg being completely different as the eggs would be in any two people anywhere on Earth today, one coming from Alaska or the Aleutian Islands and one coming from South America. You see the tremendous variety you could get? People don't think about these things, but accounting for the diversity of people is so easy. I wonder why anyone troubles over it. But leave that as it may, the egg will be released. What happens to all these cells of the follicle that are left behind? They go on to make a gland. It's an endocrine gland. Endocrine glands make hormones. These are substances that circulate in the blood. And these hormones that are made by this little gland will be essential for the development of the baby. Without this gland, you'd never get the baby to develop. You might wonder, well, what happens if no baby results from this particular egg? Most of the eggs aren't fertilized, right? You'd be a lot of children if they all were. What happens then is a signal comes back from somewhere that tells this gland you're not going to be needed this particular cycle. So breakdown. This yellow gland, which has been called the yellow gland, corpus luteum, which is fancy for yellow body, breaks down, and in its place is a scar. This scar is so big that, forget about a microscope, you can take a slide that has an ovary on it that's the size of an almond nut, you can hold it out at arm's length and see the scar. That's how big. And every month, you get another one. And in 4 or 5 months, the ovary is a solid, massive scar tissue, and it's the end of life. It's over. There are no people. Any stories you've heard about this are untrue. I've come to the end of my lecture. We'll open for questions. No. A drop your jaw and gasp miracle happens right here. The only place in the body where scars are absolutely vanished. I'll bet almost everyone in this room, probably everybody, has a scar someplace, right? I've got one right here. And it'll be there to my last day. Walked through a glass door many, many years ago. And plastic surgeons would love to make scars vanish. Just gone. But they're just a bunch of connective tissue and they hang around forever. But not in the ovary. Because if it did, it'd be the end. Those scars get 100% dissolved. And without that, well, if you're an evolutionist, it'd be the end of evolution. You don't have to worry about anything else because there aren't going to be any more organisms. It's over. And if you're a creationist, you know that the Lord has done a miracle already, right here. Well, let's move on and look at this. This is kind of like making a section, cutting through the uterus so you can see inside, cutting the oviduct so you can kind of look inside, cutting the ovary so you can look inside. And you can see that the oviduct is a hollow tube. As I say, fertilization will typically occur if it's going to occur out here. By the way, more than one egg can be occasionally produced, and that's what results in twins. And depending on which sperm fertilizes the egg, one twin could be a male and one a female, because they'd be two separate eggs, two separate sperm. Those are the usual kinds of twins, or triplets, or something else could occur, but usually just one. Now here's... You want to see a miracle? This is such a miracle that what I'm about to tell you, if we have anyone here who is an unbeliever, I'd recommend that you close your eyes, plug your ears, not watch or hear what I'm about to say, because what I'm going to show you, this alone will leave you without excuse when you go before the judgment throne of God. He's going to say, I showed you the oviduct and how the egg moves down the oviduct, and you didn't give me credit as creator. Go into outer darkness. Let's look at the wall of that oviduct. See right there, the wall? We're going to magnify it, not as a picture but or a drawing, but as a real photograph that I took of the wall of the oviduct. And these are the cells lining the wall. Ignore these little blips here. See these little hair-like things up here? They're called cilia. They're like the little hairs that are in your trachea and what have you that beat. They just go like this all the time, beating. These are, we call them hairs, but that's a slang expression here because they're much smaller than a human hair. You would need a microscope to see these. In fact, they're so tiny that you couldn't see one of them in a light microscope. You'd need an electron microscope. You say, well, wait a minute, I can see them up here. This was taken with a light microscope. There are clumps of them. It's like me looking at you. I can see hair on your head, that is for most of you. But I couldn't see one hair, right, from where I am, but collectively I can see the hair. And so we have these little hairs, and unlike the hairs in our head, as they say, they're tinier, and they beat like a little whip. They kind of go through a motion like this. They have a forward motion, and then they kind of come back like this, and then a forward motion again. And they do this at a very high rate of speed. It's the beating of these little cilia that will move the egg down the oviduct. Now, I got a question for you. There are hundreds and hundreds of these cilia on every cell, thousands and thousands and thousands of cells, millions and millions of cilia lining this tube, and they're all going to beat to move the egg down the tube. How do you plan on having them beat if you're going to design an egg tube? You could say, well, no problem, just have them all start beating. So I'll just show you two of them now. They could be like this. Imagine millions all doing their own thing. Would that move the egg? No, you maybe get a little foam. How about this? Like window wipers in a car. All sequenced, left, right, left, right. Would that move the egg? No, the egg would probably go forward, backward, forward, backward, forward, backward. Hey, you better move the egg or it's over. If you don't move the egg, it'll get fertilized right where it is. It'll implant there. That's called a tubal pregnancy. That's a medical emergency. That'll be fatal for the mother about half the time if you don't do anything. And it's always fatal to the baby. Oh my, how those cilia move is so wonderful that I'm almost tempted not to tell you. Make you beg. This is it. One way only. Back up here. We should be able to get it. Here we go. This is it. This is called a metachronal rhythm. This is the rhythm you see when they do the wave in the ball stadium. They get this thing going. It takes a lot of coordination, doesn't it? And it looks like waves going across the stadium. This is the pattern you see when you see wind blow across a wheat field, the waves that go across. It's called a metachronal rhythm. This movement, and only this movement, will move the egg down the oviduct. And to do this, you must synchronize by some kind of a signaling mechanism millions and millions and millions of these cilia. What kind of a creator do we have? We're not even close to talking about fertilization or making a baby yet. We're just figuring out how to get the egg down the tube. We've already seen a miracle that's enough to just stop us in our tracks. But oh, the Lord has other things in mind that are so magnificent. Let's move on and look at some other things. This little flow diagram is going to show you basically what I'll be talking about here. This is the egg after it's first ovulated. It's just entered the oviduct. This is 12 to 24 hours after it was ovulated. And we'll go at different times. Here's 30 hours, 3 days, 4 to 5, 6 days. That's the sequence. There's about a 12 to 24 hour window of opportunity for this egg to be fertilized. So first, we have to get it in the oviduct, and so I'll show you a picture of an egg in the oviduct. There it is. It's a cross-section through the tube. This is the oviduct out here. You can hardly make out the cilia. The magnification's too low. This is the egg. Look how big that cell is. And you see this? Looks like garbage out here, just a bunch of little cells around it. Hey, don't think any bad thoughts about those little cells, because if you didn't have those little cells, there wouldn't be anyone here in this room today. For that alone, there would be no people. You see, these little cells that accumulate around the egg, and do I have to tell you what the name is? The cells that accumulate around the egg, yeah, except the fancy name is cumulus oophorus, the cells that accumulate around the egg. These cells are not germ cells. They're just like regular body cells. This is the germ cell, the egg. See, there's two kinds of cells in the body. That's it, just two kinds. You thought it was going to be complicated. There are germ cells, that's eggs and sperm, And in our body cells, it could be anything, heart, lungs, kidney, cumulus cells, and they are not germ cells. They have the double set of chromosomes. What are they doing? They're making a sticky stuff. I call it goop. It's sticky. And the cilia that move the egg have to have that stuff, or the egg doesn't move. They've done experiments with rabbits and animals like that. They've cleaned off the egg, got rid of all the cumulus, get down to the bare egg, and then they put that in the oviduct, and they watch it with special optical equipment, and the egg just sits there and spins. It doesn't go anywhere. They put glass beads in the oviduct, same size as an egg. They sit there and spin. Got to have goop from the cumulus. You see how integrated... The integrated complexity, the things that have to work together in concert perfectly. Let's magnify this. Imagine, you got an oviduct. Think of a long tunnel like the Holland Tunnel in New York, and you have a basketball flying through the tunnel, and you have made a random section through the Holland Tunnel, and you hit the basketball flying through. That'd be pretty amazing right there, wouldn't it? That's what happened here. This section just happened to hit the egg. And when we magnify it, here's the egg. In the egg are the chromosomes. Here are the chromosomes. We just happened to hit the chromosomes, which is like hitting a BB inside the basketball. And then there's a little, it's called the plate at which the chromosomes line up when they divide, and we hit that edge on. Would you mind if I just sort of stood here and gloated over this picture for a while? I took this picture. It was a lucky shot. I think the Lord just wanted me to have it so I could tell other people about it. And so this is the chromosomes that belongs to the mom, and then the sperm cells are going to come in with the chromosomes that belong to dad, and they're going to be put together, and from that moment on, you have the beginning of a new individual, which, of course, the Lord has known about long before, but we first learned about it that time. And then this material out here is sometimes called yolk. It's different than the yolk that's in a organism that actually lays an egg, but it's called a yolky material. Well, right here, we need to digress a little bit. Once you've seen the egg and you've seen the cumulus cells, right? You've seen the chromosomes in the egg. It's instructive at this point to just touch a little bit on human cloning and some of these things you may have heard about. It's possible. They did this with Dolly the sheep, for example. They've done it with dogs and cats, and there are people trying to do it with humans, and I just hope the Lord comes first before they succeed. What they do is they take the egg. Here are the chromosomes we were just talking about. They go in with a little pipette, a little sucking device, and they suck the chromosomes out of the egg. So now you have an egg with just cytoplasm, no chromosomes at all. Pretty much a dead end for this egg, right? Then what they do is they take some of these cells out here from the cumulus. These are body cells, right? Not germ cells. They take the nucleus from one of these cells. In the case of Dolly the sheep, they took the nucleus out of an udder cell, the sheep's udder. They put the chromosomes from a cell from the sheep's udder inside the empty egg that had its own chromosomes removed. In the case of this Korean lab that's been trying to clone a human, they used the cumulus cells. They put those chromosomes inside the egg. Now, normally, this isn't going anywhere. This will just spontaneously break down. But they find that if you give it a kind of an electrical shock, in some cases, it took about 250 attempts to get Dolly, the sheep. Other attempts, it developed partway, formed kind of a monster, spontaneously aborted. So if you do this to humans, it's going to happen that way. But they finally got one to succeed, and then, of course, that sheep, like virtually all clones that have been produced by man, is an abnormal animal. It lived approximately half the normal lifespan. It died after 6 years, Dolly the sheep. There's a premature aging. There are other problems as well. So man ought never to try this on a human being. The people that did Dolly implored science never to try this on a human. They had too many disasters on the sheep. But believe me, there are labs even as we speak that are working on this. That's basically how it works. When it starts to develop, it'll get to a certain stage, then you have to reintroduce it back into a womb again. In other words, you can't bring this to a human or a newborn outside the womb. You have to go into the womb, and it will implant just as though all of this had happened in the womb. We call this a clone because it would be a duplicate of the donor of the cell. It'd be like an identical twin to the donor of the cell. Identical twins, by the way, are clones. I'm asked all the time, if they ever make a human clone, would it be a monster? Would it have a soul? I say, oh, you probably met a human clone. Identical twins are God's clones. I'll show you how that works in a bit. Okay, back here, let's look at this step. 12 to 24 hours right here. Typically, there might be about 100 sperm in the area, and only one must be allowed to fertilize the egg. You say, well, what would happen if two did? We call that polyspermy, and the whole thing breaks down. Must have only one. Well, with 100 vying like a horse race, imagine 100 horses coming to the finish line. Who wins? First nose across the line, right? Photo finish. And believe me, that's the way this works. I'm going to show you another miracle here that you have a hard time believing it. Here's an egg or a drawing. There's a shell around the egg. Don't get the idea like a hen's egg, a hard shell. This shell is like a hard gel, like you see on the edge of Jell-O. It's a gel. And it forms a clear zone around the egg, and it's been given a really creative name, the clear zone. But in Latin, zona pellucida, the clear zone. Got a clear zone, and then these are the cumulus cells in the goop. Remember the cumulus cells in the goop? You needed those to get the cell to move down the oviduct. So along come these sperm, and they are all going to try to fertilize this egg. They're attracted to it. In fact, it's been estimated from the time the sperm has left the male reproductive system and finds its way to the egg, given the size of the sperm, it's comparable to something the size of man traveling to the moon. Imagine finding your way to the moon and something the size of the moon. But anyway, this sperm is going to penetrate through these layers, and the problem is it can't. The sperm is not going to be able to get through these layers. I mean, this goop, it can't get through that. If it ever did, it would never get through this shell. You realize what this means? This means it's over. There can't be any human beings. There can't be any animals that develop this way. But if you look at what really happens, a couple of really nice miracles occur. First, there is a highly specific enzyme that's released by the sperm head that selectively digests its way through the goop. The evolutionists say, what an incredible stroke of luck. If this didn't happen, there would be no life. And the creationist looks at it and says, what a wonderful God. He thinks of everything. I can't believe it. An enzyme to work its way through. Then the sperm gets down to the zona pellucida, or the clear zone. You got another problem. It can't get through that either. It's a formidable barrier. Except a second, different enzyme actually attached to the head of the sperm selectively and specifically digests its way through the zona. And the evolutionists say, what an incredible stroke of dumb luck. If this didn't happen, it would be the end of life. Now, the sperm will get to the egg. And when a sperm gets the egg, it has no business going any further. The egg is a separate human came from another human being. Sperm came from one human being. The egg came from another human being. These two cells are as different as these two human beings are, probably not related, at least very closely. And there's no way that the cell from this human being ought to let the cell from that human being get inside of this egg. It ought to resist it. Everywhere else in the body, you inject foreign tissue. What happens? You reject it, don't you? You put in a heart from somebody else, and the body wants to reject that heart. Put in a kidney, it wants to reject that kidney. It ought to reject this sperm, but it doesn't. Evolution is an incredible miracle. It accepts it. But before it allows the sperm to come in, it does a quick inventory. As soon as the sperm head touches a membrane in the tiniest fraction of a second, an inventory is done to determine, first, that it's the same species, second, that it is a sperm cell, and once it knows it's a sperm cell, same species, then it is quickly incorporated into the egg. You say, but what about the other sperm that are, you know, just a little tiny bit behind? You got this photo finish coming up here. Oh, this is a miracle. You're not even going to believe this. You just have to trust me. There are little granules just waiting all the way around on the membrane out here with a special enzyme called ovoperoxidase. And as soon as the first sperm is accepted and gets in the membrane, these granules release this enzyme. The enzyme hardens the zone of pellucidin and stops all the others right in their tracks. And only the one can get through. And occasionally, because they're just absolutely together, two get in and then that just breaks down. And this wouldn't be an abortion because you don't have fertilization. The two chromosomes have not gotten together yet. In fact, when the sperm's inside the egg, you're still not fertilized. Let's look at that. Here's a female egg. This is the cytoplasm, the yolky material here. It would be huge. I mean, this thing would go down a couple of stories up and down here. And these two little balls in here represent, one is the nucleus that has been reconstituted around the sperm chromosomes, and the other is the membrane that's reconstituted around the egg chromosomes. And right here, you still don't have fertilization yet. You've got them both in this egg, but they're not fertilized yet. These two then fuse together. Now, don't ask me which is the female, which is the male. I don't know. They fuse together, and when they fuse together, that combining of the chromosomes makes a unique new individual. Unlike every other individual on Earth, you'd never get two duplicates. And that constitutes fertilization. And from that moment on, if you don't interfere, if you keep your hands off and don't interfere, under normal circumstances, it 9 months later results in a baby emerging from the womb. Question?
I'm just curious. Are you watching this in a live body? Or how are you doing that?
Okay. This was taken from somebody who probably died. The reproductive system was being examined, and they got this, or else it's an egg that got flushed out of the uterus of someone, a donor or whatever. In any event, it was examined in the light and electron microscope, and they could see that fertilization had been initiated but not completed. So even this would not be an abortion yet.
What about the hairs that you talk about in the tube? Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, you can actually see them beat. You can go with a microscope and watch them. You can make a strobe light and actually measure the speed that they're going. Yeah, these are things you can see. This is observable, repeatable, testable science. This isn't like evolution, but this is real science. Well, let's go back and let the psalmist speak to us again. As soon as those two pronuclei fuse, you have a new individual. And from that moment on, from that first fertilized egg, the zygote on, death. That ugly death can come in and take that baby. At any stage along the way, I lost a little granddaughter, just a few months of age. She just was ejected premature. She was so tiny, just set in my hands like this, and I had to just watch her die. The Lord is serious about sin. He said to Adam, dying you'll die till you're dead if you disobey. And they did, and it's been our lot ever since. Psalm 51 was written by King David. We have to kind of reflect on what the conditions were for this prayer. King David lusted after the wife of a general in his army. The lady's name was Bathsheba. Her husband's name was Uriah. King David wanted this soldier's wife. King David, a direct ancestor of Christ along the lineage of the patriarchs leading to Christ, King David. Put this man out in the front lines where he knew he'd be killed so he could have his wife. Boy, I'll tell you, the Bible just lets you know the story, doesn't it? It doesn't hide the warts of the... And I'm glad it doesn't. There's hope for me too then. There's hope for me too. If the Lord could love and forgive David for something so dreadful. And he did. He did. And this is David's prayer. Asking for forgiveness for what he did. And this, look at this prayer, is so gorgeous. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity. That means I came out of the womb iniquitous, a sinner, subject to death. And in sin my mother conceived me. Wow, he's gone back an earlier step. He first talked about coming out of the womb, that'd be a newborn baby. Here he's talking about conception. He says in sin. Now that probably meant his mother was a sinner, his father was a sinner to start with. And he was conceived a sinner. And death can happen at any point after that because the wages of sin is what? Death. I've had people tell me that they're no longer a sinner, that they now live a perfect life. I can't believe it, but people think that. But they say that, and I'll tell them, well, you'll know if you're right. If you're right, you'll never die. Because the wages of sin is death. Think of it. How could Jesus die? He was without sin. He was able to die because he took upon himself the sins of the world. And once he loaded up with all of our sins, he was eminently dieable. And die he did. And then rose again, the first fruits of those who will be raised in the last day. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity. In sin my mother conceived me. Behold, you desire truth in the inward parts. That means in your heart. And in the hidden part you will make me know wisdom. And then he goes on. A lot of churches don't have liturgies anymore. I thank the Lord our church has a liturgy where the people say together certain things. And certain times during the church year we say this in our liturgy. And it's beautiful. David is saying, Lord, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from your presence. Do not take your Holy Spirit from me. What a beautiful thing for everybody to say in the congregation together and think about. Now, I've often thought this is a word create here. Several years ago, I got into a discussion, a friendly discussion with a very elderly gentleman in our congregation, a wonderful saint of the Lord, since gone to be with him. And we happened to, just as Christians will do, you get to discussing things. You know, what was the greatest miracle of all? And I said, well, that's easy. That would be six-day creation. You can't top it. I mean, what's a bigger miracle than God creating everything in 6 days? And this wise old Christian friend said, no, David, that's not the greatest miracle. The greatest miracle is conversion. When God takes us dead in trespasses and sin and turns us around and sends us off in a new direction, born again, he says, that's a greater miracle. And at the time, I thought, oh, it's terrible to get old. Your brain turns into mush. You can't think straight. It took me about 30, 40 years to catch up with this old gentleman. And then I realized today, this creation is bigger than six-day creation. This is creating a new heart, changing us from a sinful way to being a child of God. What an incredible miracle that is. And that's what he does for all of us. If we're born again, it wasn't because of some particular effort on our part. It was God putting us through a birth process that is more amazing than our bodily birth. Our spiritual rebirth goes way beyond it. Well, having said that, let's go back to our chart. Let's say the egg was fertilized. And at 30 hours, we get the first cell division. It's been one cell, it divides. You now have the first two cells of the baby. At 30 hours, mom has no clue she's pregnant yet. And these are two actual human cells, again, taken from something that was flushed out of the womb or from a deceased person. This would be, sadly, a death, an abortion, because fertilization obviously has been completed, and these are two first cells of a new child. See this thing out here? That's that zona pellucida we've been looking at, you know, the little shell around it. And the shell is still there. And boy, is that a good thing that the shell is still there, because that holds these cells together. You see, later on, these cells are going to have a glue that holds them together. We call them adhesion proteins, cell adhesion proteins. They're going to have little buttons, like on a coat, that'll button them together. I talked about these buttons holding the hair in the follicle. They're called desmosomes. Those will develop later. Right now, these cells can hardly even stick together. If it wouldn't be for that zona pellucida around there, they'd just drift apart. Sometimes, and oh, is this a heavy thought? You may not even want to listen to this. It'll probably keep you up all night. But sometimes the zona is incomplete or breaks down. And if it does, these two cells can drift apart from one another. And if they do, you get two children. If they stay together, you get one child. If they separate, you get two. Now, there is a heavy thought. We get all confused. In fact, we have people say, well, clearly the Lord couldn't know what's going on here yet, so this wouldn't be an abortion yet, because as long as it could be more than one child or one child, we still haven't focused on a baby yet, And so we can do abortions at this early stage. That's the kind of logic people come up with. Believe me, the Lord is not confused by any of this. It certainly makes me wonder what on earth's going on, but the Lord knows. So if they separate, we call that an identical twin. Could it be one boy and one girl? No, they have to be the same sex. And you can get more than identical twins. I met identical triplets here a few months ago. And you can get more than that are identical. It's just the separation of these first cells. And this, as I say, is a heady thought. I don't even want to think about it too much, except it happens. And folks are always asking me, would a clone be a monster? Would they have a soul? Well, as I already mentioned, this is a clone. Each of these would be identical, having the same chromosomes. And if you've never met a human clone, here's a pair right here. Identical twins. Lovely young ladies, the Garcia girls. They just pour their heart out for Answers in Genesis. If you've been on the website, or see these beautiful quilts that they sell to get money for the museum. These young ladies make those quilts in an ancient Singer sewing machine in their little home up in Ohio. Wonderful, beautiful volunteers, and they are identical in that they have the same chromosomes. But you know, identical twins have the same chromosomes, but they have different fingerprints. Chromosomes are not the whole story. Genes are not the whole story. There are other things going on that we really are only beginning to understand. Well, back to our flow diagram here. At 3 days, we have a whole bunch of cells, not just two, we have several. But notice the overall size isn't any bigger. Normally, when cells divide, they grow again to full size, and then those divide, and then they become full size again. If that happened in the oviduct, it would get clogged. So when the cells divide, they stay half size, and when they divide again, they stay fourth size. They divide again, they stay eighth size. It's like cutting up a pie, and that allows all this to fit nicely in the oviduct. Isn't that a nice touch? And then this little ball of cells that they don't exactly call a ball of cells. They call it a morula, which means a bunch of grapes. It sort of looks like grapes. It's still a baby. Don't let these words and these names fool you. This finally enters the uterus. At 4 days, it enters the door into the uterus. It's two cells, 4, 8, 16, like that. There's the term morula. And when it gets in here, at 4.5 to 5 days, that ball of cells that originally was solid becomes hollow. And that hollow ball is called a blastocyst. You see it here. It's 4.5 to 5 days. This is a human blastocyst. Again, the source from somebody who was deceased or something that was flushed from the womb. And they found this little particle and studied it. This would be quite tiny. It would sit comfortably on the point of a pin. And this little hollow ball has fluid in here. And the part of this ball that is the baby is right there. It's called the inner cell mass. This is going to make the baby. These cells out here are not going to make the baby. You're probably wondering, what are they going to do? They're going to do something so important that if they didn't do what they do, you can forget about the baby. It's going nowhere. Imagine I bring in this projector here, this $6,000 thing, and I bring it in, and I set it up here, and I say, where do we plug this in, Pastor? He says, oh, I'm sorry, we don't have any plug-ins in this church. Am I out of business or what? Without a place to plug this thing in, I have about a $6,000 boat anchor. I need to plug it in. It needs a source of energy. I can get away with my laptop without plugging it in because it has a battery. I can get away for a few hours. We are like plug-in devices when we're developing in the womb. We need to be plugged in. Now, when you plug something in, it's just a couple holes in the wall. Could it be that complicated? No, there's a whole power plant. Isn't there attached to that? That power plant's more complicated than the projector. So you need to make a whole power plant, only it's infinitely more complicated than any power plant on Earth. And that power plant is the placenta, and from that all the nutrients and energy is going to be derived to get the baby going. Now, birds and reptiles, they're like battery operated. They don't need to plug in. They have a certain amount of battery life. You hope that the little bird or the reptile develops before it runs out of juice from the battery. But we're plug-in. So before you can worry about doing very much with the baby, you need to tell the baby, would you mind waiting up a little bit? We got work to do. We're going to go ahead and make a nice plug-in for you. And that's basically what happens. It's this blastocyst that is actually going to penetrate into the uterus, like planting a seed in the soil. At 5.5 to 6 days, that's when the implantation occurs. And the cells that are shown in red here in this illustration, they're the ones that are going to penetrate. They're the cells that are going to form the placenta. Now, what I'm going to describe now to me is one of the really big miracles of birth, or the early development of the child. These cells start out looking like regular cells. They're a bunch of little balls with nuclei, right? These cells start fusing. You get two cells here, here's one, here's one. They get together, now you got one cell with two nuclei. Does that make sense? You fused it. Another cell comes in, it fuses in. Now you have one bigger cell with three nuclei. Another one comes along, fuses in, you have four. And it keeps fusing, and it keeps fusing, and it keeps fusing, and it keeps fusing until you end up with an absolutely immense cell with millions of nuclei. It makes the biggest cell in the body by far. You should be asking, how big is it? It's about the size of a good-sized area rug. That's a big cell. Now, it's all folded up into an incredibly complicated folded system, so the whole placenta ends up being about 7-8 inches in diameter, but if you could really flatten it out, it'd be like an area rug. And it's one cell. The entire surface of the placenta is one seamless cell with millions of nuclei in it. What this means, on one side of this huge seamless cell is the baby's blood, the other side is mom's blood, and they're separated by a seamless structure. The only way you can get from one side to the other is to literally penetrate through the cell. Also, these cells secrete a special protein called HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin, and all these little pills that you can use and strips, test strips to determine whether you're pregnant. They're measuring HCG. This is the first signal you get in the body that you could be pregnant, is the production of HCG. So how early could you tell? About 7 days, 7-8 days. Okay, here it goes. This is the baby waiting, saying, I wish you'd get on with this placenta. Just kind of waiting here, the blue and the yellow. The green is the placenta. These are where the cells are fusing. And it penetrates right through the wall of the uterus. The uterus shouldn't allow this. This is another whole separate human being that's penetrating right through an organ in the mother's body. And it does it without ever creating a leakage along the edge. It keeps a seal. What's it going to do when it penetrates? It's going to make contact with arteries and veins in the mother's uterus. Big arteries and veins. Half the diameter, maybe lead pencils. What's it going to do with them? It's going to erode the ends of the arteries and veins right off, like taking a garden hose and cutting it, and just the water flies. Huh? That's a risky thing to do. That's a really risky thing to do. What are you going to do with this blood once you cut off the ends of the arteries and the blood just starts coming out like out of a garden hose? You better have a way to seal it and keep it in. Well, what's going to happen? Here's the next step. See, it's getting close to this artery. Here's this seamless cell forming here, this big, we call it a syncytium, when nuclei are many in one cell. And then it goes a little further. Notice it hit the artery. And spaces are beginning to develop inside this huge cell, the syncytial trophoblast, we call it. And this blood is going to flow into these spaces. And it will not be allowed to leak out. Keeps it all sealed. Well, here you have it. Mother's blood is now flowing into these spaces. Baby will start developing in earnest now. And the baby will make its own blood vessels. It'll come out close to the mother's blood, but never fuse and mix with the mother's blood. Always this green layer here will separate mother's blood and baby's blood. Let's see what it looks like in a real stillborn fetus. This is a 40-day fetus, 40 days of development. You can see it here. And at this stage, the placenta goes all the way around the baby. Later, it's going to just be a disc. Here, it goes all the way around. And look how complicated it is. It looks like hair. What it is, think of a tree. You got a trunk, you got all these branches, and the branches finally get down to a lot of twigs. What you're seeing there is like about 20 trees with zillions of little branches that almost look like hair. And inside the branches and twigs here, all these little hairs, is the baby's blood. Where's mother's blood? It's out here in the black area. And so baby's blood is inside these little hair-like processes, these little twigs, and it's bathed in the mother's blood. But there's a seamless cell covering everything. One huge seamless cell. Several years ago, I did published the first papers taken of these little tiny twigs with the scanning electron microscope. This is one of the pictures from that publication. This is one of those little hairs magnified in the electron microscope. Oh, it gets ridiculous. It turns out that these little hairs, we call them villous processes, have little microvilli. They have their own little hairs within the hairs. Imagine how much surface area there would be if you straightened this thing all out into one sheet. That's why I say it'd be like a large area rug. One cell. Everything you see here is one cell. Mother's blood is out here. Where's baby's blood? It's inside. To see baby's blood, we'd have to cut this open. Let's do that. We're going to make an incision right there, and we're going to look in from the end in the light microscope. This is mother's red blood cells right here. Belongs to mom. These down here, that's mom. These red blood cells inside the vessels here, they're the baby's red blood cells. And notice mom's red blood cell here and baby's red blood cell here is separated by a seamless pink stained material. That's what was green in the drawings. That's this seamless cell, the syncytial trophoblast. What gets back and forth across here? Well, just about everything. Oxygen must come from the mother's blood. It must diffuse across this membrane and get to baby's blood for baby to breathe. So the placenta is a lung. The baby's lung isn't even working yet. In fact, the baby's lung isn't going to function as a lung until after the baby's born. Wow, what do you plan on doing in the meantime? You're going to use the placenta to be the lung and breathe. A baby can be born with absolutely no lungs whatever and be perfectly healthy until the placenta unplugs, then they die. This placenta is going to be the baby's kidney. It's got its hands full just making kidneys. It can't really use them very effectively yet. And so the placenta serves the entire function of the urinary system. A baby can be born with no kidneys. It does just fine until after it's born, and then it dies. It's the baby's endocrine system. It's the baby's liver. It's the baby's digestive tract. You see why I call it super organ? It does everything. And when the baby's born, we all sit and goo and gaw over the baby, the placenta, right? Throw it away. I think you ought at least thank the Lord for a placenta that has served all these functions of all of the organs. Sure, now focus on the baby, but this selfless organ, the placenta, has done wonderful things. Now, I need to share some sad things with you here. If the mother consumes alcohol, alcohol can go passively from the mother's blood to the baby's blood such that a baby can be born with fetal alcohol syndrome. Doesn't require any special pumps or carrier molecules. It just goes across passively. Sadly, a number of recreational drugs, so-called, can also get across, like cocaine. Mothers that use cocaine can deliver babies that are crack babies. It's really kind of sad because those things go across passively. You can't keep them out, whereas other things that are critically important for the baby do not go across passively. You have to have really complicated proteins called carrier molecules to get them across. For example, the baby needs iron to make its blood. Guess who gets the iron? The placenta gets it from the mother's blood. The placenta has special proteins called transferrin. Complicated proteins, and if the whole of evolution are reduced to making one copy of transferrin, you could be certain that evolution didn't happen because there's not enough time and material in the universe for one copy of transferrin. The probability would be essentially zero. And you have to have a carrier protein for hundreds of other substances that are carried across selectively to get to the baby's blood. Oh, what a beautiful system. I look at what the Lord does, and I've just gotten to the point I don't question anything anymore. If the Bible said that Noah's Ark was a teacup, that'd suit me fine. Because if the Lord wanted to put the animals in the teacup, that's where they'd be. I just don't question him. I mean, he's bowled me over so many times that I just say, Lord, whatever you say, that's fine. I'll just take it. Now, this is a drawing of the way the placenta looks in the term, baby. These are the arteries and veins in the uterus. This is where they've been literally cut off. See these little trees? Looks like trees upside down, trunks with all the branches. Those are those villi I was showing you. There's about 20 of these. They're called cotyledons. Each representing a major artery. And then down here, there are several arteries and veins that have been cut off, and it's just like taking a hose and going up to a bush when you water the bushes and taking the hose and right into the bush and let the water run over everything. The placenta is sealed at the edge so the blood can't get away. All of this blood bathes these little trees, and inside the branches of the trees are the baby's blood. Now, when the baby's born, the baby comes out first, attached by the umbilical cord. Now, what keeps the umbilical cord from getting tied into knots and kinks so the baby can't breathe and get any nutrients? You ever thought of that problem? Oh, the Lord has a miracle here. I should charge you $5 a piece to share this with you. The umbilical cord contains a tissue found nowhere else in the body. It's called Wharton's jelly. It's kink-proof almost. There are three critical blood vessels in there. Two arteries coming from the baby, and the reason there's two arteries is they really come from arteries going into the legs. You've got two legs, so that's two arteries that come up to where the belly button is and then go out. And there's how many placentas normally? One, and you have one vein coming back from the placenta. That's three blood vessels. And the baby's going to do wingovers, loop-de-loops, all kinds of interesting aeronautical acrobatic movements. Ask a mother sometime. And you don't want to twist up or kink the umbilical cord. And this Wharton's jelly makes sure that no bends are tight. Oh, the Lord thinks of everything. Everything. And now do you want the biggest miracle of all? I can't top this. This is as big as it gets. The baby's born and comes out. And then the umbilical cord is severed and the placenta is delivered later as part of the afterbirth, right? The placenta tears off from the uterine surface, literally taking part of the uterus wall with it, leaving behind 20, roughly 20, severed arteries nearly the size of lead pencils. Blood has been flowing out of these severed arteries at the rate of approximately 1 quart per minute. And you're just going to tear it loose. There's the blood. Anyone see a problem here? How long you figure the mother would live under these circumstances? Minutes. It doesn't take long, and you get all the blood in the whole body would be gone at the rate of a quart a minute. No time at all. Boy, I'm telling you, the Lord better have a miracle in mind here. Physicians have said this is the worst wound by far that any human being ever gets and lives to tell a story. And if you think it's serious to have 20 severed arteries all of a sudden, releasing a quart of blood a minute, you still don't know how bad it is. Did I forget to mention that the whole blood clotting system is shut off in the placenta? Where are we now? We basically have a hemophiliac with 20 severed arteries. Anybody see a problem here? Now, if you're an evolutionist, this has to be the biggest you ever do in your whole life, because this is a drop your jaw and gasp and can't get up kind of miracle, because what does a surgeon do when an artery gets severed? How does he keep it from bleeding? He uses a little clamp called a hemostat. God put a hemostat on every one of these arteries. When the placenta unplugs, it unplugs on the side away from the hemostat, leaving it with the mother. Hey, if the hemostat went with the placenta, you bleed to death. But it breaks off, leaving a little sphincter. It's like a purse string. It's a little muscular sphincter on each of the arteries and veins, and in a fraction of a second, it just snaps shut. So you lose a couple cups of blood. Now, there is a miracle for you. That is a miracle. Imagine if you're an evolutionist, you can do nothing except incredible stroke of the most extraordinary dumb luck. And that's what you can teach in our schools today. But you wouldn't dare go in and suggest that this shows intelligent design or this shows the handiwork of a creator. I recently spoke on this very subject to a group of high school seniors taking advanced biology. I actually had a thought policeman that was sent from the school who was on the evolution committee for the high school who sat in my room and warned me before I began not to even mention the word design. Now, Washington University School of Medicine, we had atheists. I had one atheist there who gave a lecture, and in one of his lectures, he used the word design 20 times. He'd be thrown out of a school today for doing that, high school. So you could use the word design at Washington University School of Medicine, but I couldn't teach in your local high school and use it, I'll bet. Oh my, what kind of a world are we getting into? I guess I just want to just sit back and look at what God has done and try to stay as far away from the world as I can, but hey, we're part of it, aren't we? Well, I don't have time to tell you how all the organs develop in the baby. It's too profound, it's too marvelous. I think what we'll do is we'll just jump right on ahead and just quickly look at what happens at the time of birth. There it is, 9 months later, here's a baby, ready to go. Umbilical cord, blissfully unkinked. Placenta right here in position. Baby's head down, good position to be born. And have we got a problem now? Have you heard about the guy that built a boat in his basement and didn't measure the size of the door? Spent a long time building that boat, and he can't get it out of the basement unless he cuts it up in parts and takes it out. There is no way on earth you're going to get this baby through that birth canal. And I mean that literally. It will not fit, period. The head is bigger, not just bigger than the soft tissue. I mean, that can stretch or be cut. It's bigger than the bony pelvis opening. Anyone see a problem here? I think our evolution friends are ready for another incredible dumb luck. Let me show you the nature of the problem. This is the bony pelvis of a female. A male, you wouldn't even come close to getting the baby's head through. Not even close. It's shaped like a funnel. You'd have to put the baby through the funnel, and it would look like it went through a funnel. This is sort of conical, but instead of being like this, it's more like that. The baby's head still doesn't fit through. Anybody got any solutions here? If there can only be one solution, you're going to have to take this pelvis apart, temporarily. Open up the bones, let the baby get through, and then put it back together again. You can see why we got another incredible stroke of dumb luck coming here. There are three seams in this pelvis, which is a ring of bones fused together. There's a seam right here. That's the famous sacroiliac you've heard about. This is the sacrum, that's the ilium, that's the sacrum. So sacroiliac junction right here. There's two of them, one here, one over here. And then there's another junction right here, the pubic junction. These three seams are held together by very tough ligaments that allow just a little bit of flexure. And that's good, because if you jump from an airplane or you jump off a ladder onto the ground and hit the ground like that, if your pelvis were solid bone, the heads of the femurs would just shatter, and the pelvis would shatter. But by having a little bit of give to it, it takes up some of the jar. But it doesn't have enough give to let the baby through. Ready for another miracle? Special enzymes are produced that digest partially these ligaments, allowing these three bone sections to open up just a little bit. You still can't get the baby's head through unless you turn it 90 degrees like a key in a lock. It's got to be turned. You know that when the baby's born, you're going to have to turn it. If you turn it, get the head in just the right position, with the opening up of these bones, it just fits, and a baby's born. Oh, and your problems still aren't done yet. The baby's born, its lungs haven't been working. In fact, the arteries have bypassed the lung, except for just enough blood to keep it alive and keep it developing. You better have a solution for that, and fast. These arteries here, instead of going to the lungs, just one little tiny vessel goes to the lungs. Most of the blood has a shortcut right here. And this shortcut goes right to the aorta and to the body and skips the lungs. You must have instant replumbing, or the baby dies. Down here is the liver. I mean, the liver is one of the most complex organs in the body. It does literally hundreds of different biochemical steps in processing the food we absorb from our intestine. But the baby doesn't need an intestine because the placenta does that, and it doesn't need a liver because the placenta does that. So it's got all kinds of time to build the intestines and build the liver. But as soon as a baby comes out and he's unhooked from the placenta, for the first time, you need to start using all of these other organs. And you see this vessel going through here? That's a bypass that bypasses the liver. Just a little bit of blood goes into the liver, enough to keep it alive. By the way, here are the vessels coming up from the legs that come up to the umbilical cord, and here's the umbilical cord containing its blood vessels. What happens at the time of birth is this little bypass has a muscular sphincter, just like he had in the placenta, that closes down instantly and forces the blood to go to the lungs for the first time. Baby comes out, hold him upside down by the legs, whack him on the back a few times, starts breathing, and away it goes. All this plumbing gets shut down. Little hemostats close off the shunts. Down here, the shunt that is skipping the liver, it gets closed down, and its place in our body is a little ligament. We've got a ligament here called the ligamentum venosum. Doesn't do a thing. It's a leftover from the embryo. Up here, we have the ligamentum arteriosum. It doesn't do a thing. It's just left over. You know, you've heard about vestigial organs? Creationists say there are no vestigial organs. Evolutionists say they're vestigial organs. These are supposed to be organs left over from our evolutionary ancestors. Well, I got news for you. The body's full of vestigial organs, but they're not from evolution. They're from embryology. They're from our development in the womb. There are all sorts of places where you can see little leftover vestiges of things that had a function in the womb but do not in the baby after birth. Well, sometimes babies are born a little too soon, and you weren't going to get through this lecture without hearing about my grandson, Hayden. He was born 2 months premature. I could have gotten my finger ring on his wrist almost. And he was in the neonatal intensive care unit. And boy, I'll tell you, that was an experience. I don't know how many of you spent a lot of time around there, but you learn very quickly that a healthy baby is not a foregone conclusion. I'd go over to the well baby side of the clinic and see all the grandparents looking at their babies, and there were little children just dying in the neonatal intensive care unit. Sin is just ugly, and it affects even the little children. And this little kid here, he just obviously didn't know about everybody dying around him. The Lord spared him, hooked up to all kinds of equipment. You see, he was born 2 months premature. His lungs can't breathe yet. They're not ready. They needed those extra months to develop. What's the problem? Ever take a sandwich bag and put a little bit of water inside the sandwich bag? It kind of clings. Or if you put two pieces of glass, you put a drop of water and put the glass together, you can't pull them apart. Have you noticed that? That's because of surface tension. Those forces are measured in tons per square inch. You have to break molecular bonds to pull that glass apart. You have to slide it apart. In the lung, there's water in there, and the little membranes of the lung are like the little sandwich baggies, are just locked shut, and there's no way you're going to open them up. Tons per square inch of pressure are holding them closed, and this little baby has to breathe. Now, a little later, there's a detergent, just like washing detergent that's produced. It's called surfactant, and the surfactant breaks down the surface tension so the little baby's lungs can open up, but this little child can't make the surfactant yet. And so they had to kind of help him breathe with special equipment, and they had to get surfactant in there and do all kinds of little tricks to get that going. And with a brain hemorrhage and a lung hemorrhage, he did survive, and he's doing really pretty well now considering. But you know, 8 months of age, that's an interesting age. You know why that's an interesting age for this little baby? Because that's how old John the Baptist was when he met Jesus for the first time. He was 8 months of age in the womb. By the way, as I watched this little child, he smiled. He's 2 months from being born yet, under normal circumstances, and he's smiling. What was he smiling about? I don't know. Do babies smile in the womb? I guess so. He should still be in the womb. I would imagine he'd be smiling there too. As long as somebody doesn't abort him, he keeps smiling. Let's just look at John the Baptist. This is a heady thing. I'm not going to push this too far. I'm just going to let you think about this. You know, Elizabeth and Mary met. Mary, 8 months pregnant, roughly. I'm sorry, Elizabeth, 8 months pregnant with John. He'd be the age of my little grandson when you saw him there. And Jesus was younger yet, 4 months, something like that. And they meet. And Elizabeth says to Mary, "Indeed, as soon as the voice of your greeting sounded in my ear, the babe leaped in my womb for joy." Now, let's be careful here. It would be very easy to say, "Oh, isn't this nice? I mean, the mother's imagining this. I mean, we all know the baby's kick." I mean, how does she know he was kicking for joy? How does she know he was leaping for joy? This is God's word we're reading here. This is the Bible, not just some lady talking about her child. You may bank on it. John the Baptist leaped for joy. When did he leap for joy? He leaped for joy in the presence of his Savior, Jesus Christ. He's a sinner. He could have died right there, as many little children have. And there he was in the presence of his Savior. He's in the womb. 2 months left to go yet. And he's expressing joy for his Savior. Don't ask me to explain this stuff. This is just one long list of things I can't explain. I just take God at his word, and I've come to not question anything because he's never failed to deliver yet. There are things we need to learn here yet, I think. And indeed, we've looked at the first birth, but we all need to be born twice, don't we? Need to be born twice. Jesus was speaking to Nicodemus. Jesus answered and said to him, "Most assuredly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God." Nicodemus asked the question I would have asked if I were there at the time. He said, "How can a man be born when he's old? Can he enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born?" Hey, Nicodemus, that would be the easy way. I can almost imagine it. It's a little bizarre, but I can almost imagine it. But what Jesus was talking about is a birth that's infinitely more complex, infinitely more profound than the first birth. And give a little bit of thought to how much you contributed to the first birth. You were the cause for the occasion, but did relatively little on your own part. Is that not true? And I believe in the second birth, it's like that in spades. It's God's work. It's God's work that does it. He takes you, turns you around, sends you off in a whole new direction. And all the praise and all the glory goes to God. He uses our brain, he uses our eyes, he uses our ears, he uses sainted teachers. But it's God's work. Well, if you appreciate that lecture, want to share it with other people, pretty much the way I gave it, even some of the funny comments. It was all very nicely recorded with the original slides going directly into the video, not taken off the screen. And it's the most popular DVD sold by Answers in Genesis. It's had a lot of impact on the pro-life community. So if you have a pro-life ministry or want to share with people on that topic, as well as creation, you may be interested in getting copies of this and sharing, and they're available out there. Other lectures you've heard while I'm here, the hearing ear and the seeing eye, that's available out there. I do a lecture on Lucy. Got a clever title, Lucy, she's no lady. That's supposed to be one of our evolutionary ancestors. So what I did is rather than talk about all the ape men, I just focused on that one. And we really go in some detail. Again, it involves some humor. It certainly involves God's word. And it's called Lucy, She's No Lady. And just for starters, to whet your interest, very likely Lucy was a male. And from there, the story really deteriorates rapidly as far as evolution is concerned. But you may be interested in that. One of my favorite topics is a Scopes trial. Most fascinating trial that ever took place in America. In fact, you can get the whole transcript for the trial out there. The first year I read that, it was the most interesting book I read that year. It's vastly better than any book written about the trial. It's absolutely stunning to see how times have changed since 1925. That whole trial took 12 days, including 4 days of selecting the jury. How times have changed, huh? But you may find that interesting. I have a talk on dinosaurs. It's a little different than other people do. It, again, involves some humor. It involves God's word, and you learn a lot about the biology of dinosaurs. And then I have a talk very much like I gave here the first evening, just dealing with evolution and the implications and scientific criticism of it. And you can get the whole bundle on a special for $49 out there. So if you're interested in a whole package, are available. You can get individuals, I think, for about $9 or something. By the way, if you subscribe to the magazine, the Answers magazine, which is just coming out, it's new, it's going to be tremendous. It's about an 85-page magazine, all in color, written for the general family, a pull-out section for children, featuring Buddy Davis with Answers in Genesis. And if you subscribe to that magazine, you get your choice of any DVD you want free right now. Then the magazine will come within a month. And then four times a year after that. This is a wonderful book. I didn't write it. I wish I did. My dear friend Gary Parker wrote it. It's called Life Before Birth. It covers sort of what I've done here, but in a way that little children can understand. And if you know anybody who's having a baby, maybe yourself, you got other children in the family, and they're asking, Mommy, what's going on in your tummy? You've told us there's a baby. How does that work? And this book is just beautiful, written by one of the most delightful Christians I know, Gary Parker. And Dr. Parker has put this together, and it's a neat book. And I couldn't think of a better book to give as a gift to somebody that's having a baby and has maybe other children in the family. This is written by another of my favorite people, Dr. Werner Gitt, a marvelous scientist in Germany. He's basically ahead of what would be the National Bureau of Standards over here. He's ahead of that in Germany. He's a Bible-believing Christian. He gave a lecture at Harvard. He gets to the end of the lecture talking to a bunch of Harvard professors and students. He's sharing God's word. He gets to the end. He says, "And if you do not believe this, you go to the hell." He just gave it to him. He's a beautiful guy. And he wrote this book, The Wonder of Man. And it's full of color illustrations, and if you kind of like getting into the human body and just being bowled over by the marvels, this is good. If you want to dig into a little more technical, we have this book out there too called Body by Design. And that gets a little bit more technical, and if you're interested in that sort of thing at a deeper level, you may like that book. Our most popular book is the Answers book, The 20 Most Asked Questions. We have some package deals out there. I think you have this deal, the adult pack, if I'm not mistaken. Regularly $80.93, sells for $59, and it puts together some of our most popular books. One of my favorites is One Blood. It's the only real solution to the racial problem in our country, is to appreciate that God created us all from one blood. Adam and Eve are the parents of all of us, and Jesus Christ died for the sins of all mankind, not just for white folk or just for black folk or brown folk. And this book, I talked about it before. My friend Ken Ham, who's an Australian, you don't need to know any more than that he's an Australian to understand that title. They do not beat around the bush. He's talking about evolution, and it's called Valai. And it deals more with the spiritual implications. In other words, why is this an important issue for the Christian? Here's Henry Morris's book. Henry went to be with the Lord just a couple of months ago. One of the great pioneers of the whole creation movement. Was with the Institute for Creation Research in California. It's now being continued by his son, as it has been, John Morris, for a number of years. His book on the Genesis record is a commentary on the whole book of Genesis, written by a fellow with very deep scriptural knowledge, comparable to a very well-trained pastor. And also, he's a first-rate scientist. He was the chairman of engineering in two major universities before he got involved with full-time creation work. He wrote the definitive book on hydrology for engineers, still used in some universities. We have other packs. Look for them out there. You get a little discount with the packs. And you can get a lot of information just on our website. And with all of that, put your name on our list to get, I don't have a copy of it here, I thought I did. But we have a sign-up sheet where you can get on our mailing list. Please do that. And I think what I'll do is we'll just end it here. If there are people who are interested in learning a little bit more about the museum, I have a video I could show in like 15 minutes if you want to see that, or if you want to ask questions. But I think for now what you really need is a break and an opportunity to get books. And this is officially the end of our session, but if you want to come back and see the video or ask questions, I'd be happy to stay on a little longer and do that. Thank you.